Okay, good morning. So I guess there is a midterm coming up next week, and I put up two old exams onto the website, so you can see those. Okay, and so then what I thought I would do today was another example of dealing with Banach spaces, just to get a little bit more experience with those, and then a nice property involving products, and then just get started on the special case that we'll be focusing on for a while, which is a power series. Okay, so for Banach spaces, so let me just do an example with a new one. And so recall, and I want to sort of bootstrap on what we already know. So we already have that if we take the continuous functions on a bounded interval, say 0, 1, and use the soup norm, this is a Banach space. And all right, and let me just do an example of a another example. And so theorem, if I take the twice differentiable function, so we already saw how to put a Banach space structure on the one times differentiable functions, but you can just keep going, and there's a whole sequence you can build. And so let me do an example. So let me call it C2, because that's where it works, is a Banach space. Okay, and for that to make sense, of course, I have to tell you what this means, right? So I have to tell you which norm I'm talking about. So where the C2 norm of a twice differentiable function is defined to be a little bit like the one norm. I'm going to take the largest value that the function f takes, okay? And then I'm going to take the largest value that the derivative takes. And then I'm going to take, actually, I'm going to do something a little bit funny here, and I'll show you why later, but I'm going to put a half here. It's not needed for this Banach space structure, but it's convenient for some other facts, for the second derivative. Okay. And just to make sure that it's clear what that means, let's just try a couple of examples. So if I take the two norm, the C2 norm here of this, of the function x in, I should tell you what space this is in. So I'm in C2 on the closed interval 0, 1, just like I wrote up above. So is it clear what this is? So it should be just the function x soup norm. And then the derivative, right? So that's gonna be 1. And then the second derivative, so that's just gonna be 0 times a half. Is that clear? And what is that?
Two.
Right, exactly. So because we're on this interval 0, 1, the biggest value for x is just 1, right? So we have a 1, and a 0. So this is 2. Okay, and just one more, which I'll come back to why I chose these two later, but what about x squared?
Five.
Almost. I snuck this.
So four.
In. Four, correct, exactly. And so yes, this is going to be the norm of x squared, the soup norm of x squared, plus the supernorm of 2x plus the supernorm of 2 times this 1/2. So as you say, it's 4 now. Okay. all right. So that's the norm. And I want to check that this is a Banach space. So let's just going to run through how you would prove this is a Banach space. So proof. And we just go through the steps. So what do we need? So the first thing we need is that the function is, the space is a vector space. So C2, 0, 1 is a real vector space. Okay, because if we add two things, then we can still take the derivative. So bilinearity of differentiation. Okay, so that's one thing that I need. I need to, so I have a vector space, great. So then the next thing I need is that this is a norm on that vector space. So maybe I'll just note here. So, all right, and so we want that C2 is a norm. Okay, and so there are three parts to that, right? So first I have to say that if its value is zero, then it had to be the zero function. So if the C2 norm of F is equal to zero, well, that means that the supernorm of F is equal to zero plus the supernorm of the derivative plus half the supernorm of the second derivative, right? Actually, all three have to be zero, right? They're positive things or non-negative things. We're adding them to get zero, so they all have to be zero, right? So in particular, the supernorm of F is zero. And actually, let me just mention as a side, we're not going to need it right now, but it's also true, of course, that the other two are also zero. Okay. But once I know that the largest value that my function ever takes is zero, well, then the function itself has to be zero. So this is enough to be the function is zero. So F is zero. And that's what we needed for the first property. Okay, second property. So we want to say that when we multiply by a real number, it just multiplies by the absolute value of that real number. And again, we're going to use the linearity of a differentiation to make that work. Okay, so if we have some real number k and some function f, then we have to just compute that if I take this C2 norm of k times f, well, by linearity, the k just comes out of all my derivatives. And then since the supernorm behaves correctly, this k just comes out of the supernorm too. So then this, we just get this is, let me try it this way, the absolute value of k times the supernorm of f plus the absolute value of k times the supernorm of the derivative. So just looking at the three terms, plus half the absolute value of k times the supernorm of the second derivative, which is exactly what we needed. So this is, in other words, the absolute value of k times the C2 norm of f. Okay, so again, the two that I claimed are usually the easier two to check are go through in a straightforward way. And so then the remaining property for being a norm is the triangle inequality. And so that says that if we have two functions, f and g, then, okay, we just want to get a bound on the norm of the sum. So if I take f plus g and I try to compute its C2 norm. All right, so again, I can just split it up into supernorms if I know more about it. So let me just do that. So I can just write this as the supernorm of the sum, just copying the definition. So plus the supernorm, and now I'm gonna use linearity. So the derivative of the sum is the sum of the derivatives. And of course that holds if we do two derivatives too. So we have the f double prime plus g double prime and half of its supernorm. Okay, and so now to get the inequality that I want with the triangle inequality, how can I do that? So I'm gonna take that first one, of course, and I wanted that to be bounded by the supernorm of f plus the supernorm of g. And how do I get that first one? and the rest will be similar. Right, so how do I get this inequality here? Let's take more terms.
Is that just triangle inequality?
Yeah, that's exactly the triangle inequality for the soup norm. And we already know that the soup norm is a norm linear space. So we just use the triangle inequality for the one we already know for the soup norm. And then, exactly. So this is, and then the other two, of course, the same. So plus the soup norm of the derivative f plus the soup norm. So I'm going to get six terms here. 1/2 the soup norm of the second derivative of f, and then finally 1/2 the soup norm of the second derivative of g. Okay, just applying the triangle inequality for for the soup norm three times. Right, and we get the one. And so now then they just recombine, and so then this is equal to exactly what we wanted, which is the sum of these two C2 norms. So this is the C2 norm of F plus the C2 norm of G, and we're done. Okay, so we have that it's a norm, just bootstrapping on the fact that we already had a norm here, and basically we just added up a bunch of these norms, and it's still a norm. Okay, so that's the norm linear space, and the only thing left for a Banach space. So let me just note here this. So this now tells us that this is a non-linear space. So for a Banach space, all we need to do is check that every Cauchy sequence is in fact convergent, and then we're done. Okay, so it remains to check that Cauchy sequences are convergent. So let's assume that we have a Cauchy sequence and check that it's convergent. Okay, so So last, check that C2 Cauchy implies, that's what we have to check, C2 convergent. Okay, that's the goal. So let's give ourselves a C2 Cauchy sequence and then check that it is in fact C2 convergent. All right, so if we have a sequence at Fn, and it is C2 Cauchy. Let's see, so what does that mean? If we just unravel the definition, that says that for all epsilon greater than zero, there exists some m, and whenever I take little n and little m bigger than or equal to this capital M, I have the usual condition for Cauchiness, which is that the difference between Fn and Fm in our norm, so in this case that's C2, is less than epsilon. That's the definition. Okay, and if we just write out what this is telling us, so I can just expand everything back into soup norms, which I understand better. So let me do that. So this is just telling me that the soup norm of Fn minus Fm plus, that's soup, plus the soup norm of the derivatives, Fn prime minus Fm prime, plus half the soup norm of the second derivative, is less than epsilon. Okay, but if this, if the sum of these three things, all of which are non-negative, is less than epsilon, what do I know about, say, this one? How big could that one be?
Third epsilon?
Almost. It could be that this one, that these two are both zero.
I see, epsilon.
Yeah, so that's right, but epsilon. So at least we can bound each one by epsilon, right? Because none of them are bigger than epsilon. They may not all be equal, but none of them are bigger than epsilon. And so then that's enough. So we're going to get that each of those is Cauchy. Okay. FN is Sutnorm Koshi. And same with FN prime. And same with FN double prime. Okay, so they're all Sutnorm Koshi. Okay, and what do we know about Sutnorm Koshi sequences?
They converge uniformly.
Exactly. So they're Sutnorm convergent. And let me give it a name to say F. And so then this one is also Sutnorm convergent. And let me give this a name and say it's G. And this one is also Sutnorm convergent. And let's give it a name, let's say H. Okay, so all three of those are Sutnorm convergent. So we have these three Sutnorm convergent sequences. Now, what we would like, of course, is a C2-norm convergent sequence. That's our goal. So we want just one function this is converging to. And so we need to relate F, G, and H. And to do that, we're going to make use of the one theorem we have that relates things like that, which is 9.18. Hence, by theorem 9.18, okay, and does anyone remember what that tells us? So if I have, let's just look at these first two. So I have this function, this sequence converging uniformly to F, and its derivatives converge uniformly to G, then how are F and G related?
F prime of x is equal to g of x.
That's exactly correct, right? So people remember that. So that's the power of this 9.18. It says that when these converge, it actually is the case that g is in fact the derivative of f. So we can do the derivatives first instead of second. So it commutes with taking this limit. So it says okay. So hence by 9.18 we have f prime g is equal to f prime. And if I again apply 9.18 to the second pair, then what do I learn?
G prime is equal to H.
Exactly, yeah. So G prime is equal to H. So H is equal to G prime, it's equal to F double prime. So I've gotten them all related. So I have H is equal to G prime, which is equal to F double prime. And so just summarizing what I have up here, this one is equal to F prime, and this one is equal to F double prime, okay? So that's what I've got. Okay, so I have a candidate F, and I just have to check that my sequence converges to F, and I'm done, okay? So that's the last thing to check. So hence, let me just write out what I know here, and then I'll conclude my sequence does converge to, in particular, F. Okay, but just if I just write out what it tells me, I have for all epsilon greater than zero, there exists, and let me just do all three of these at once. Okay, so I've got these three facts, and I'm just going to write them all together in one thing, because why not? It's shorter. Okay, so there exists L, M, and N. So whenever I have, say, little L bigger than equal to big L, little M bigger than equal to big M, and little N bigger than equal to big N, I'm just putting all three of those things together. Then I have, well, the first one converges. So the norm of Fn minus F in soup is less than or equal to, and I can put anything there. And now here's where the third is going to come in. So here I'm going to take it to be a third epsilon, okay? Which I can do. And similarly, derivatives Fn prime, and not only, and now we know that that's actually approaching F prime, right? And in soup norm. So that's also less than or equal to epsilon over three. And then finally, we know that the second derivatives are also converging, and they're converging to the second derivative of F. And again, that's in soup norm. So we have these three facts, okay? And now I just want to put those together and get what we want. For all epsilon greater than zero, there exists Okay, and so what do I want? I want some R, and if I can fill in this R, what it is equal to, then I win. But let's just write out what I want from that R. So once I find that R, then I'm gonna say that whenever I take a little r bigger than or equal to that big R, then we have the goal, which is that the C2 norm of Fn minus F is less than epsilon. Okay, that's my goal. I shouldn't have all these equals, so it doesn't really matter. Okay, so can anyone see what capital R should be to achieve that goal?
The max of Lm and n.
Exactly. So does everyone see that? So if I take capital R as suggested to be the maximum of those three, then each of those three equations holds whenever R little r is bigger than big R. And then when I add them, I get, you know, epsilon over three, epsilon over three, and that's actually epsilon over six because there's a half there. So the whole thing is less than epsilon. So I win. Okay, so this is equal to the max. Of L, M, and N. Okay, and so we are done. The sequence Fn converges in C2 norm to F QED. Okay, any questions about how you go about proving something like that?
I had a question, I guess, but not on the proof.
Okay.
Is there such a thing as like a Banach subspace? Because it's like, yes. proving that it is like a, like I guess a Banach space is a bit tedious. And so
yeah. Yeah, it is a bit tedious. And a Banach subspace, yes. So in fact, of course we can't do it right here because we had a new norm, right, that we're dealing with. This, we hadn't seen this norm yet. But if you had another subspace of that and the same norm, then just like a vector subspace or a subgroup or something like this, yet there are fewer things you have to check if you know it's a subspace and you want to check that it's a Banach subspace. Yes, you are correct. And so, for example, things like the zero part, that's going to just follow from the fact that it's a subspace. Linearity part, that's going to follow. The triangle inequality, that's going to follow. The only part that's going to be tricky is this last one, where you want to make sure that, and actually part of that does follow, because the if you have a Cauchy sequence in this bigger space, it's going to converge to something in the bigger space, and all you're going to have to prove is that the thing it converges to is actually in the smaller space. So yes, so it's considerably less work to show that it's a Banach subspace than just a Banach space. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Good. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay, let me just do one more computation just to motivate this one half here. And then move on to power source. So why the half? And it's because there's a nice extra property this has, which goes by the name of Banach algebra. I'm not going to define them, but I'll just note the kind of fun extra property that it has. And it's a little practice playing around with these norms. So we get Banach algebra structure. And the way that we can see this is that it relates well to products. So remember, we noted that we have a product rule for derivatives, which is very useful. And that allowed us to say that most of these spaces are preserved by products, except for D0. But in particular, then, that means these C0, C1, and C2 are. And it works nicely with the norm. And that's what's nice here. So note. So first of all, let's say I just take two continuous functions. So if I have F and G, which are in C0, 0, 1. Then what can I say about the relationship between the maximum value that the product takes on, so the supernorm of the product, and the product of the supernorms, the maximum value that F takes on multiplied by the maximum value that G takes on.
That's less than equal, right?
Exactly. Yep. Right. If they happen to take the maximum at the same point, then it would be equal, but they might be at different points. But it's certainly less than equal. That's right. So we get this inequality. And now we're going to try to make that work in some more examples. So, if I have F and G are in C1, so they have one continuous derivative. Then I want to compare the C1 norm to them. So if I look at the C1 norm of FG, so this is, okay, well, let's just write out what it's equal to. So it's equal to the supernorm of FG plus the supernorm of the derivative, but I know how to take derivatives of products, so let me just do that. So it's F prime G plus F G prime. Supernorm, okay. And now I'd like to bound this. Okay, let's see. So this is less than or equal to. Well, of course, I can use what I just did above to get the first term to be bounded by the product of the supernorm of F and the supernorm of G. And now I want to pull this apart into a product of this norm and that norm plus that norm and that norm. So how do I do that? So how can I, first of all, get rid of this, split it into two?
Triangle inequality again?
Yes, exactly. So that's going to involve the triangle inequality. And then I'm going to apply the inequality above. So let me write out the answer. So then we're going to get this bounded by the product of the supernorm of F prime and G and added to the product of the supernorm of F and that of G prime. And as you mentioned, this involves the above three times. And the triangle inequality. Right. Okay. And so now that I claim that this is related to the product of the original norms, so this is less than or equal to the product of the supernorm of F added to the first derivative of F, which is just our C1 norm, times the supernorm of G plus the supernorm of the derivative, which is by definition the C1 norm of F times the C1 norm of G. And so is this clear? So for example, why is this an inequality instead of an equality? Is that clear? So if I just multiply this out, if I just FOIL it out, I'll get these four terms. I'll get this one.
Missing one, right?
Exactly. We're missing one. That's right. That's the one we're missing. That's exactly right. So this has got three of the four terms in it. But it, as you say, it's missing this F prime times G prime, right? Okay. So that's, maybe I'll just note that. Okay. Actually, let me just give you a couple minutes to try to prove this for the C2 case, and then we'll just move right on to power series. But let you try it yourself. So try to show. Exactly the same statement. So if I have F and G, but this time in C2, then if I take the C2 norm of the product, this is bounded by the product of the C2 norms. And actually, let me add one other thing. So this is true, something to check. But this would have been false if instead I were to define the C2 norm without that half in there. So this is why the half is relevant. So let me just call this a tilde because it's the wrong one. But if I just take the first guess that one might have had, so just the sum of the three soup norms, then if I use this new norm, it's actually a perfectly good norm. It gives a perfectly good Banach space, but it doesn't have this Banach algebra structure. And so this is not true. For some choice of F and G. So the quantifiers there exist F and G. Okay, so are the statements clear? Well, let me just give you 3 minutes then to sort of play around with that. So probably need to break out and hopefully I can get you back. Thank you. Okay, let's see. Let me just label these A and B. So did people figure out either of these two?
I didn't finish A, but I was just expanding everything out and combining like terms up, and then was going to try to find a similar trick to the one that we did together above.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, that's that will work. Did anyone else try that and actually get it to finish up? So as suggested, we'll have these terms. Right, we'll end up with terms like this. And if we look at at that, right, so we'll have something that looks like FG, something that looks like F prime G plus FG prime. And what do we get for the second derivative? So it's just going to be the derivative of this, right? So we're going to get four terms, right? So we'll have the product rule here and the product rule there, right? And two of them are the same, so we'll end up with f double prime g, and two copies of f prime g prime, one from each term, and then one copy of f g double prime. Does everyone agree with that? That's what we end up with. And so then when we go through and multiply, like you said, there'll be nine terms here. Right, that we have to sort of see if they all work out. And and here we're gonna have, oops, I left out my half, didn't I? So there we go. Right, and then they're gonna be, and here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 terms. And so we just wanna, so three of these we're gonna throw away, and we just wanna make sure that we get the right coefficients. We do that. Okay. So that ought to work. Okay, you guys should feel free to work that out in detail. I don't see any need to do the details unless there are questions about how that would work. Clear. Okay, and then what about B? What's the example? It's the one that we looked at before. So if I just take f of x equals g of x equals x, that works. So then we computed above that the norm of x squared, the C2 norm of x was equal to 2 above, right? And the C2 norm of x squared was equal to 4. Above, and so that's fine. But what about this C2 tilde norm?
That gave us 5.
That gave us 5, exactly right, yeah. And so that's too big, so that's the problem. Oh, and yeah, so this is equal to 5. Oh, and sorry, and I guess the very last thing to do is what's the C2 tilde norm of X? I'm sorry, I don't have this still on the screen, but if we go back to what happened when we computed for x, right? That half had no impact, right? Because this term is gone anyway. Right? So we're still going to get 2. Okay, so that's a good second example. Okay, any questions about norms? Okay, then what I wanted to do is, as I said, the special case that we'll be focusing on for a while, which is power series. So let me go back then to power series let me start with a theorem about how it's basically just a summary of what we've already observed about how series compare to sequences, and then some notation for power series and then some examples. So I guess it's actually, this is 2 theorems, but I will list it that way. So this is a theorem 9.21 and 9.22, which I will combine. So it says the following: if we have a non-linear space, and we have a sequence of usually functions, but we're actually interested in it as a series, so we'll write it that way. So let me call it a capital F sub capital N for the partial sum N runs from 0 up to capital N of these little Fs. So this is the situation we've been in several times where we use a series. In that setting, then we say that well, first of all, we can just compute that the sequence, which is this series here, F sub capital F sub capital N, is Cauchy if and only if, and this is what we observed before, we just write down the usual definition of Cauchy. So for every epsilon, there exists capital M. For every little n and little m bigger than or equal to this capital M, we have to have that the difference between two functions is small. But if we compute the difference, since these are series, right? If we take a series all the way out to M and a series out to series all the way out to M and a series out to N, the difference is just this partial series. And that's what we've observed before. And we're just going to write that down formally. So let me just write that out. So this is then the sum where our N, runs from N plus one, so anything bigger than N, up to M of these Fj's, right? That's what the difference is, okay? So that's what it is. And so that has to be less than epsilon. And that's just the definition, basically, okay? In this special case. And then B, though, this is not the definition. It's Cauchy if and only if. And Cauchy if, but this is much easier to check. And that's why we're going to list it here. If, but not only if. So here's an easier criterion. So we want this sum, the norm of the sum to be small. Well, we're okay if we take the sum of the norms being small. That's harder to achieve, but easier to check. So it's a useful fact. And so that's what we're going to ask for. So the sum of the norms of these fn's, and actually you can start anywhere, but let's just start at 0 to infinity, exists. Or equivalently, another way to write that is less than infinity. Another way to write exists. So that's a helpful criterion that we can use for when a series converges. Okay, so now the particular class of series, we've already looked at some nice ones that gave us this Weierstrass function, but now we're going to move over to this very special class, which is the power series. So let me just write out the notation for power series. All right, so a power series about C with coefficients A sub n, and actually A is, it's the wrong article. It's actually the power series. There's only one of them. Coefficients A n is, so it's the sum of these A n's x minus c to the n, and n runs from 0 to infinity. And this notation just means the limit, but it's shorter, so we like to use it. Capital N goes to infinity of the sum little n equals 0 to capital N. That's just what that means. Okay. All right, and so this is the way that we write out power series. Let me just write down now two examples. And I don't think I will have time for the theorem that tells us something about it, but we can at least think through what happens. And these are familiar examples from when we were looking at one way to get power series, which were these series with a Lagrange error. This is two of them. So A, I'm going to take the sum of x to the n, of course, n equals 0 to infinity for both of them. And then B, I'm going to take the sum x to the n over n factorial. Okay, and I hope it's clear how these fit into this notation. So in this case, what is C for each of these?
0.
Right, so I hope that's clear. So this then fits exactly into our notation. So C is 0 and AN is 1 here, and AN here is 1 over N factorial. So that's just how it fits into our previous notation. Okay, and so the types of things that we would like to know are for which values of X these converge, right? And so let me just say, we don't have enough time to go into breakouts, but let me just think for a moment and see if you can spot values of x for which the first one converges and fails to converge, and similarly for the second one. So so note for A, this sum of something to the n converges, and the sum of something to the n diverges. So what could I put inside there?
Would it converge when x is from 0 to 1 and then diverge when x is greater than or equal to 1?
Yes, that's exactly what's going to happen. That's the complete answer. Let me just give examples, but that, as you say, is the complete answer. So for example, if I put in 1/2 here, or if I put in 2 here, then it diverges. And in fact, as you say, any absolute value of x less than 1, it will converge, and absolute value of x greater than or equal to 1, it will diverge. So this is what we'll get. And we'll write down a theorem for that later, actually as soon Monday morning. But this one is clearly diverging, right? Because it's 1 plus 2 plus 4, et cetera. So that's clearly diverging. It's getting bigger and bigger. And this other one is, I guess it's 2. So it's converging, right? So that's right. What about the second one? If I, what values in B here, if I want one that converges and one that diverges?
Doesn't n factorial grow fast enough that it should work for larger values of x?
Yes, that was a trick question. Correct, yes, it does. So it in fact never diverges, right? And so that's, so I could put in anything here. So for example, 1, it converges. And actually, what does it converge to?
E to the x.
Yeah, and what's x?
E.
Yeah, just E, because I plugged in 1. So this converges to a number, and it's e to the x, and x is 1, so just E. And as you noted, this is related to e to the x, and this is related to 1 over 1 minus x. They're not quite the same, particularly in this first case, but they are related. And so we will see in the sense in which they are related and get these facts that people were just mentioning about how we can figure out exactly when they converge and when they don't on next week. Okay, we'll turn off the recording and stick around.